Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 20th of March, 2024, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And we're here to talk about some of the latest news from the UK construction industry, as per normal. And there's loads to choose from today, isn't there, Phil?
We were trying to narrow it down to our usual three topics, and we'll try and keep it to three, but we might have some tangents thrown in occasionally.
Yeah. Some interesting things to talk about. What do you want to kick off with, Phil? Health and safety, I think, is probably the first one on our list.
Yes, I think, I can't remember whether you addressed this topic before, but back in December last year, we reported that Australia had become the first country in the world to ban the use of engineered stone. This is because when you cut it and work with it, it kicks up silica dust, which is... Mm-hmm. Like asbestos dust. I mean, it's horrible. It's a killer. And there'd been a big campaign in Australia, and we then, sometime later, I miss the fact that actually in January, after the news of this broke, the Australia story broke, there was questions in the House of Lords to the relevant minister for. Mm-hmm. Safety or work or something in the House of Lords asked whether, you know, the UK should be following suit with Australia. And he basically said no. And then the next mm-hmm. time I reported anything about it was a couple of weeks ago when a 5th of March, we ran the story, a shop in Canterbury, a kitchen fitter slash seller mm-hmm. Called Herringbone, not a company I'm familiar with, but judging by the shop front picture, they're obviously quite posh kitchens that they sell.
They simply said
that we're not going to sell engineered quartz, which is the main engineered stone that's used for kitchen worktops. Said we're going to stop selling it. We've seen what Australia have done, and despite all our best preventative measures that we take, precautions that we take, we're simply not prepared to take any risks with this material. Therefore, we're not going to sell it. Now, okay, that's quite interesting. Is the tide turning against engineered stone in the UK too? And then last week, we received something from the British Occupational Hygiene Society, basically saying that, it's horrible if you're cutting it and you're not keeping it wet and you haven't got your apparatus set up correctly. But actually there's no need to ban it. We just need to, you know, as long as we take precautions, a bit of education, good practice, we do not need to ban engineered stone in this country. Which I thought was interesting, but it might not be the end of it. What's your take on it?
Well, I can remember when we reported the Australian thing, and it seemed to me a little bit sort of left field, really. I mean, I'd never heard anybody in this country even raise the possibility that cutting this material could be damaging to health. I mean, the thing is that if you cut any product, you know, with a disc cut or something like that, you're going to kick up a load of dust. So you've got to take the necessary precautions, you know, obviously wear a mask of some sort, presumably the appropriate type of mask. There are various types available. So just protect yourself against it. But no, that wasn't good enough for the Australians. They said that the risk was just too high and that they weren't going to tolerate it. So I can see why this company in Canterbury has decided to follow suit. It seems to be a logical precaution to take. I don't think anybody else has done the same thing. But what did surprise me was some of the figures that came out of this, which is that, you know, you think of natural stone as being, you know, containing a lot of silica, and it does. But I mean, different stones contain different amounts of silica. There are other minerals in there. And I think granite can be as much as sort of 70% silica, but marble can be as little as 5%. So the amount of silica in natural stone isn't the same across the board. But the really astonishing fact is that these engineered stone products can contain up to 97% silica. And I think quartz is basically just pure silica, obviously bound together with some sort of resin, which I assume is probably only a small proportion of the total amount. So yeah, clearly silica levels in engineered stone dust are very, very high. So that would seem to back up, you know, the logic behind the Australian thing. Whether or not it's as dangerous as asbestos, I don't know. And I suspect that nobody knows, actually. You know, we've had other scares apart from asbestos. There was MDF, for example, the dust from sawing up and sanding MDF was highly carcinogenic, I think contains high levels of formaldehyde as well as obviously wood dust. What else? Well, just cutting brick and stone, you know, silica dust and the dust and the fibers from glass fiber insulation can also be harmful if you ingest them. Whether or not these other products and materials are as dangerous as asbestos, I really don't know. But, you know, we don't take any risks with asbestos, do we? You know, if you're going to go near any loose asbestos, you've got to dress yourself up like a spaceman. It really is a very dangerous material. So, you know, I think the jury's out, quite honestly. Nobody else seems to have followed suit when it comes to, in this country, when it comes to banning the stuff. But this company in Canterbury might be the first of many, I suppose.
Well, I'm just looking at the short debate they had in the House of Lords back in January. The UK has a silica exposure limit of 0.1 milligrams per cubic metre, which is twice the legal limit in the United States and Germany and four times the limit in Portugal.
Oh.
I suppose Portugal's probably got a lot more stoneworks than... I mean, we don't really have stoneworks in this country, so there's not a lot of working with it that goes on. But so there might be a case for tightening it. But the minister, Viscount Younger, also said that there'd basically been there's no knowledge of any reported cases of, I don't know if it's illness or death from silica.
Right.
But one of the problems, he says, is that silicosis is not necessarily diagnosed by doctors and recorded on death certificates because you have to be fairly specialist. And you know, normally it just go down as, you know, chronic obstructive pulmonary, whatever. And it's not routinely sort of said, oh, exactly what dust or nasties were in the lungs that causes this respiratory disease.
No, but I think, you know, the precautionary principle applies here because, of course, asbestos, you can be exposed to asbestos and it not actually manifest itself as, what is it, mesothelioma or some other type of cancer that it causes until, you know, years and maybe decades later. And in fact, a lot of people say that there's a huge problem looming because a lot of people who are exposed to this stuff back in the, I don't know, 60s, maybe even the 70s, they're not chronically ill yet, or they might not know they are, but cases are going to come to the surface in huge numbers fairly soon. I don't know the exact figures about this or what the experts say, but we do know that asbestos takes a long time to actually kill you. And it might be the same with silica dust that people have been breathing in for years. Somebody might have spent their entire life installing kitchens and cutting this stuff up only to retire and suddenly find that they've got some sort of awful cancer as a result of, you know, their occupational exposure to this material.
But the stuff that the British Occupational Hygiene Society put out last week, while its bottom line was we don't need to ban it, it clearly is saying there is a problem, there is an issue. They said that since that House of Lords debate, the Royal Brompton Hospital in London has identified at least three confirmed cases of silicosis in the UK. So there's evidence that it's more prevalent than reported because of widespread misdiagnosis, just like asbestosis.
Maybe
if we become more aware of it, we might suddenly have to rethink whether we should be quite so, well, we shouldn't be relaxed about it. But
have we heard anything from the manufacturers or the suppliers of this material in the UK? Because it's quite popular.
Well, there aren't.
So there must be people out there who are sort of quaking in their boots.
It's mostly imported. The only factory workshop that I know of, Wren, the big name in kitchens, I gather it's Europe's largest quartz workshop in worktop processing set place in Scunthorpe, and it opened a couple of years ago, I think. We have a photo of that, and it's clear from the photo. I mean, these guys got, you know, hazmat suits on with, you know, water sprayers, and you look at that and say, okay, they know what they're doing. They're doing
they're not
it
taking
properly.
Any chances.
And I think there's a certain classic British sense is that, well, you know, we're doing it properly. It's in Australia, it's sort of little workman with his, hammer, mallet.
Well, but that's probably the same in the UK.
Boomerang, just sort of banging around in the caves somewhere, and they're not proper civilized people like us. There doesn't appear to be a, I don't want to say back street, but an under the arches kind of worktop industry that there is in other countries.
No. Well, but I'm sure that there are small, micro companies in the UK fitting kitchens. I mean, they're might be cutting it on site.
Not really. It's pretty hard to get. No, they wouldn't be cutting it on site because you need nice beveled edges and everything. These things arrive made to measure from the suppliers, in my experience.
Well, I'll let you into a secret here, Phil. I've got a little bit of this stuff in my kitchen. Two little bits of workshop over the side of my cooker were wood, but they got horribly stained. And then a friend of mine who was having a really posh kitchen installed had a skip outside his house with some offcuts in it. And I looked at these and I thought, ooh, they just about fit either side of my cooker. So
you ground them down to fit, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't. I haven't. In fact, I haven't ground them down at all. One of them is slightly proud of the the worktop or of the drawer underneath it. And I had thought that I'd shave a bit off with an angle grinder, but it's only a tiny amount, about four millimeters. So I haven't bothered to do that. But my point is that although I didn't cut it and I didn't have anybody else cut it for me, this was an offcut from my friend's kitchen, and clearly it was cut off on site. So I think there must be some work going on site where they sort of, you know, trim a work surface to length or something like that. I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure that you would necessarily cut out the opening for a sink, for example, on site. That was probably done in a factory. But these were offcuts, so, you know.
Well, my advice to people is stick to granite anyway, because we 10 years ago or so, we had we switched from a black granite worktop to a whitish quartz one. And we're only persuaded of the quartz because we couldn't find a piece of granite which was...
Well, engineered quartz?
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. So our whole kitchen is this stuff.
Right, okay.
And it's not... it's much more uniform. All the granite pieces are a bit sort of blotchy and natural looking and natural faults. A bit like your knots in your timber kind of thing. And my domestic boss said, no, we want a nice clean look. And in hindsight, it's a less functional. There are restrictions on cleaning products you can use on it. The restriction of you can't put a hot roll. We're told we can't put a hot pan straight on top of it. And it's just, it's not as, I'm sure we probably can, but we don't. We've been told not to, whether that's because it will stain or crack, I don't know. But granite, as ever in these things, the natural material is always best.
Sure, you know,
your wool and your cotton are better than your nylon. It's always that and the other. So go granite, folks.
Okay.
Or wood.
Right. Okay. And there was another story about dangerous materials out there this week, or last week rather, which was quite interesting, although highly predictable. You know what I'm alluding to here, don't you? The anybody who has modern plumbing might find that they've got these push-fit plastic pipes underneath their engineered stonework surfaces.
Yeah.
Well, they'll kill you as well, apparently. Tell us about it.
We know we're not supposed to be drinking water out of plastic bottles anymore. They've become bad. And similarly, according to the Copper Sustainability Partnership, which was an organisation comprising two competing copper tube manufacturers. Mm. So they would say that, wouldn't they? But
yes.
They may well be right. Plastic pipes, yeah, the water will have microplastics in it, possibly, eventually.
Yeah.
Because over time, and if there's been any cleaning chemicals, but why would you wouldn't put cleaning chemicals through?
No, but you'd flush them down the sink. You'd flush them down the sink so they'd go through your oh, hang on a second, that's the drainage.
But they're not. Yes, that's the drainage. Yeah, you don't care. Well, you know, goes down the drain, but you're not going to drink through the drains, are you? But the stuff that, you know, the clean water. Anyway, the argument from the copper pipe people is, ooh, plastic, microplastics, bad.
Yeah.
And I'm sure the plastic people will come back and say, ooh, copper, you know, tarnishes, rust. Doesn't rust, does it?
No, it doesn't rust, but it does corrode.
Corrode, that's the word. It goes blue or green or whatever colour it is. So, yeah, my first reaction is, pah, what a load of nonsense. And then actually, everything you read about plastics these days, it's just bad in so many ways, and microplastics.
It's a bit of sort of bandwagon jumping, I think. They've also lit upon what you've just noticed, which is that everything plastic is bad at the moment. You know, microplastics, you know, in the water courses, even in the deep oceans, and, you know, things like turtles choking on plastic bags, you know, the whole thing. Anything plastic is bad, particularly microplastics. I think that's a real trigger word, microplastics. So the cusp people have thought, well, you know, look at these plastic pipes. They must be releasing tiny particles into the water, and that'll kill you. So I think that, you know, yes, they would say that. They might have a point. There might be some risks of associated with plastic pipes, but there are risks with copper pipes. I mean, copper is poisonous. Now, I looked it up. It can cause liver failure. I mean, you know, you've got your water. Do you remember when you were a kid, Phil, when you drew a glass of water from the tap, were you always told to run the tap for about 30 seconds before you actually filled your glass?
Yes.
Because I was always told by my parents, because the water in the pipe is bad for you because it's been sitting in that pipe all night. And
well, I still do that, because if you've got a mixed tap, you're getting hot water out first, so you've got to get rid of the hot water.
Yeah. But then, you know, I still do it, still run it for a bit. And of course, I shouldn't do that because I'm wasting water, and that's bad for the planet as well. But
I just want to interject briefly.
Go on, yeah.
I can't remember the last time I heard anyone drawing a glass of water. It's like, when you go down to the pump at the bottom of the garden and draw it from the well. But you still draw water from a tap, do you?
Well, yeah, I think yes. Yeah,
I mean, it's excellent.
I fill my kettle with freshly drawn water. Yeah, I thought everybody did that.
Beautifully archaic. This is why you're the journalist.
I remember my grandmother telling us she lived in a village near where you live, actually, Phil. So this was back in the sort of first quarter of the 20th century. She lived in a cottage which was attached to another cottage, and they both drew their water from a well at the bottom of the shared garden. And she said that even in the heat of the summer, the water in that well was so cold that if you drank a glass of it straight down, it gave you a headache. That's good water. Anyway, but yeah, getting back to what I was saying, copper is poisonous, and presumably, I mean, obviously, you haven't got so much oxygen. I don't know. There's obviously oxygen in water.
So what you're saying copper can cause liver damage, though. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it can. Copper poisoning, if you get poisoned by copper.
Poisoning?
Yeah, I'm not saying that you will necessarily get poisoned by it.
Well, this is, the copper people will see your liver poison, your liver damage, and raise you with, they say that plastic pipes can cause, you know, in the right, bad, wrong circumstances, plastic pipes cause cancer, pulmonary fibrosis, cardiovascular problems, diabetes, obesity, irritable bowel syndrome, and reduced sperm count.
Wow, that's virtually everything then, isn't it?
Just about everything.
Yeah.
Apart from making you deaf and blind.
Obesity, that's the interesting one. Drinking water through
fat water
to make you fat.
Fat.
Yeah, no, I don't get that. I'd like them to explain how drinking water through a plastic pipe will make you fat. I mean, drinking milkshakes through a plastic straw will make you fat, but I'm not sure about drinking water. I mean, we used to have domestic plumbing used to be, and the clue is in the word plumbing, used to be lead. I lived in a house once which had lead pipes. We had them replaced with copper, of course.
The only place for lead piping is in a library.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. I don't really go for that. But I did enjoy their press release. I thought it was quite interesting.
Marketing, eh?
Yeah, marketing. Definitely marketing.
I got quite irritated when I received a report from Barber ABI, who are a very important organisation. They monitor all new contract awards and what's going on in the construction industry, and they filter their data through to the Office for National Statistics. Mm-hmm. And so when you see the Office for National Statistics talking about new work and construction activity and construction output and all these sort of things, they're relying heavily on people like Barber ABI. Mm-hmm. And Barber ABI are not the only people at this game. There are others, you know, Glenigan, Builders Conference, all these people are monitoring what's going on and selling their research to contractors or suppliers to the industry who are looking for business leads. So what they say is important, but equally, we have reason to be suspicious of anything that these people say about what's going on. And I cite as evidence when they put out their report saying that UK construction contract awards reached their highest level in February 2024 for 7 months. Mm. So February was the best month since whatever it was, June last year or whenever. And actually, infrastructure contract awards in February were double those of January. Now, the reason why all of these numbers were so high and why February was such a great month was because that was the month that National Highways said, if we get permission to build the Lower Thames Crossing, the tunnel under the Thames between Kent and Essex, if we get permission to do it, a planning permission, and if we get the money to do it, that contract will go to Brieg Murphy joint venture, and it'll be a 1.34 billion currently is what we think it's going to be. A 1.34 billion contract is going to go to Brieg Murphy if and when we ever get to build this tunnel.
Well, that's the question, isn't it?
As far as Barber ABI are concerned, well, that's a done deal then. Yeah. We'll put that on the list. Which is, it's useful information to know that this BMJV has got the contract, and other people can stop, you know, working to try and get the work because someone's already lined up for it. But it's completely bogus to extrapolate from that. Therefore, whatever it is, £7.1 billion of new business was signed by contractors in the UK in February. I know of that £7.1 billion, that £1.34 billion, there's no money coming through. That is not yet happening. It may never happen. I don't know how much of the other 5.7 billion that Barber ABI is saying was signed was really signed either.
No,
to, it raises just puts, that question. It just puts, I mean, it's not like a little, you know, Mrs. Jones's greenhouse may or may not get built. This is a major blooming project, which
a very controversial one as well.
Yes, with the slightest bit of analysis, they should say, okay, we'll make a note of that, you know, that's useful information, but we cannot call that a new order. We cannot call that you know, that's a new order for UK construction. I think they've blotted their copybook there, and it annoys me.
It is misleading. I think
therefore, we cannot believe the Office for National Statistics if that's the sort of information they're relying on.
Yeah. I mean, if you simply say that 7.1 billion pounds worth of new business was signed by contractors in the UK last month, I mean, they could turn around and say, yeah, well, we have signed. You know, we have an agreement with National Highways that if this goes ahead, we'll get the contract. You know, we've signed on the dotted line. So they might justify it by saying that. I mean, the fact that they might never get to actually start work on it and that the money might never start flowing is perhaps a different issue. The fact is that they've signed something with the client, which like a sort of a statement of intent.
And if National Highways has promised to pay this joint venture, 1.3 billion, and the project never happens, that seems a very rash use of public money to me. Now, it's possible, I don't know, it's possible that they have awarded BMJV a pre-construction contract, which might be worth, you know, a few hundred thousand. It might even be worth a million, I don't know. But They have not committed to handing over 1.34 billion.
No.
And they won't do so until the government A says, yep, here's your development consent order signed, which has not been signed. And B, the Secretary of State concerned, who won't be Mark Harper by then, I strongly suspect, says, yeah, in fact, not even Secretary of State, it'll be the Chancellor. It'll probably be Rachel Reeves. So he'll have to say, yep. Here's the money. You can have it. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are too many what ifs, aren't there? I mean, it's very, very far from a done deal. It is. I can see why you're irritated because it's fake news almost, isn't it? It paints a picture that is, you know, just an illusion at this stage. You know, nobody should plan against this.
Or for it.
Or, yeah, exactly.
Mean. Yes. Yes, one that is going ahead, or at least it's got the development consent order.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's got the money signed off yet. The A66 Northern Trans Pennine project. This is the road that goes from Scotch Corner, the A1, due west, roughly, to the M6 junction, whatever it is, the junction 40 of the M6,
right.
Penrith to Scotch Corner.
Yeah.
Major job. It's not a new road. It's lots of bits of dual carriageway and lots of bits of widening and improving.
Yeah.
An upgrade of the route. And 1.5 billion scheme. What's interesting about this is that the benefit cost ratio. And when did cost benefit ratio become benefit cost ratio? Accentuated.
When they decided to put things in alphabetical order, I think.
it's now a benefit cost ratio. It always was cost benefit.
Yeah.
The benefit cost ratio is 0.9, which means as it's less than one, it's got no net benefit. It's actually your
economic benefit.
Technically speaking, you're wasting money.
Yeah.
I don't think it's pure. Is it pure economic, or do they add sort of social value into those sort of equations?
Well, I don't know, because I mean, the government said when this was pointed out, you know, Mark Harper did acknowledge that, you know, the BCR was below one, but somebody in his department said that BCR is only one component of the business case and that other impacts and benefits need to be taken into account in making a decision on the application. Rather helpfully, they didn't explain what the other impacts were. So I don't really know. I mean, I said, but this has been
this has been
rumbling under for years, hasn't it? This project, it's been talked about. It's been one of those sort of totemic road projects which has been waiting in the wings to get on. And I suspect that maybe people just, you know, really just want it, rather like Brexit, to get it done. And that, you know, they've invested so much in planning it and lining up all the contractors and doing this, that and the other and getting the coast clear, that they think, well, you know, we're in so deep, we might as well carry on, even though it's not necessarily going to be good value for money.
I think politically more than that. I mean, they've scrapped the only bits of HS2 that made any sense.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, they're supposed to be levelling up. They're supposed to be, you know, loving the north of England and doing things. And if they don't do this road, it just, I mean, I know there's a strong anti-Rhodes lobby and a lot of people would much rather have, you know, protect the countryside. But the sense that northern infrastructure is not worth investing in and not worth upgrading, I think it would just be for the Tory government now. I mean, Labour might be able to get away with it in 6 months' time or a year's time, whenever the election is. But for the Tories to do it, they can't. They've that job they've got to go ahead with, even though it makes no financial sense.
Yeah.
They've already proved themselves economically illiterate anyway. I mean, not necessarily poor old Rishi, but the Tories as a whole, thanks to what Liz Truss did. So they've blown their economic competence case. The last thing they want to do is further blow their We Love the North credentials.
Yeah, they've got all those Red Wall constituencies to worry about, haven't they?
Yeah.
So politics again.
Not Blue Wall, as I just called them. Okay, yeah, this is a bit of a left turn, but it's more politics, I suppose.
Yeah, it is.
Do you take the Telegraph when you draw water from the tap?
Actually, I don't. I used to take the Telegraph, but I get nearly all my news online now. In fact, virtually all my news I get online. And actually, the reason I don't take the Telegraph is because I'm too tight-fisted. They've got a paywall. So I haven't got a subscription to the Telegraph online. And I occasionally pick a copy up, usually at the weekend. But I do take The Spectator, which is also a publication
same
which
group.
Is tied up. It's same group. So, yeah, I mean, this is, we're talking about press freedom here, which might seem like a completely irrelevant topic for Phil and I to discuss. Although I suppose we're in the media rather than in construction, so you could say this perfectly natural. But this is a story about this, I think it's an American company called Redbird, which is financed by somebody from the UAE. Is it the Abu Dhabi royal family?
The owners of Abu Dhabi. Basically, they're the money behind Redbird IMI, who were all set to buy the Telegraph. Did a deal with the Barclay brothers or the administrator for the Barclay brothers. I'm very confused about where the Barclay brothers are in all of this now. But the Barclay family, I should say. But the government has said that they will not allow any overseas regime to own, influence or control any newspaper or news magazine in this country. Now, whether that means national newspaper or the Racing Post, the legislation's not been laid. We don't know exactly how far it will go. And the argument is, and it's one I have a lot of sympathy for, is we don't want our national newspapers, which have a lot of influence in political debate, public opinion, voting behaviours, etc. We don't want them owned by companies who... by countries, by governments, by dictators, perhaps.
Yeah.
Should Putin decide to buy the Sun, who have a different agenda from free speech, equal rights, democracy, and all that good stuff that we hold dear and sacred. But why I think this is particularly interesting, and why I think I put free market, I think, above free speech. Well, two things. One is saying an awful lot that, I mean, The Independent has now got a lot of foreign money behind it.
Mm, it's owned by Russia.
And it's owned by the son of a KGB agent.
Yeah.
And the idea that suddenly all people who read The Independent are suddenly voting communist is I don't think there's any evidence at all to back that up.
No.
And I think if the Telegraph was bought by whoever and that materially changed its coverage, I think that would materially change its commercial viability and success. For one, would just stop reading it. And I think other people who are reading it would also stop reading it because they thought, well, it's just full of, Chinese propaganda or...
Yeah, absolutely.
Arab propaganda or Russian
or devalue
whatever.
It.
So it's a bit kind of it's the media who've been leading the campaign against the Abu Dhabi yeah. people buying the Telegraph, because they don't like the idea of it, because they think they might be, you know, have less freedom. Well, I think they probably would have less freedom. But I think that they would be far more impacted than the readers, frankly. Anyway, by and large, I'm perfectly happy not to see...
looming, isn't there? We are coming
I'm coming at the construction angle. Yeah. I'm perfectly happy for the government to ban foreign states buying or controlling our newspapers. I don't really have a problem with that, even if ideologically at heart, I find it anti-free market. What I do have a problem with is the contradiction that they're saying... Behind all of this, the government is talking to Abu Dhabi, who own Man City, by the way, and no one seems to be saying, oh, they shouldn't be allowed to own Man City, football club, that is, that, oh, you're very rich, you've bought Man City and they're doing very well. How do you fancy buying Sizewell Nuclear Power Station and building Sizewell C? And there is an implication that somehow the Daily Telegraph is more important to national security than a nuclear power station.
Yeah.
That's where I have a problem.
Yes, I agree. And you're not the only one, of course, because the people who are campaigning against Sizewell C have jumped on this and made exactly that point that, you know, are you telling me that a national newspaper is more important than our nuclear power network? I mean, let's not forget that EDF is building Hinkley Point C, and EDF, Electricité de France, is actually owned by the French government. So it's the French government building our nuclear power station in Somerset.
That might be, that is certainly controlling and influencing. It's definitely got influence. Control might be too strong as well. Actually, EDF, the French state used to own it completely, but that's been diluted.
Right, okay.
And EDF in the UK, I think British Gas has got something like 20% stake in EDF UK, or one of those big British energy companies has got a percentage of EDF UK. It is still, you're right, Electricité de France. And, of course, we let the Chinese have 20% of Hinkley Point C. The Chinese state, perfectly happy to have them, let them have influence.
Yeah. But that's why Abu Dhabi's been invited to have to get involved.
Yeah, you're not as bad as the Chinese. Come on
because
in.
You're not as bad as the Chinese because they recognised that having China involved in Sizewell C was probably beyond the pale. So they kicked China off the deal and touted it around to the Arabs. I mean.
You can't have our newspapers, but you can have our power stations.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, I agree with you. I'm in favour of banning foreign states controlling our national media, because I don't suppose the government would have any major problem with Abu Dhabi owning or controlling the construction index. I'd like to think that, well, I would, but I'm not sure that the government would. But something like the Telegraph, which I think is probably the most popular...
It's often described as the in-house paper of the Tory party.
That's right, it is, isn't it? Yeah. It's a very influential thing. And as you said, it has an appreciable influence on national debate and politics. And clearly, if you allow that sort of power to fall into the hands of a less liberal state, and one that doesn't share our basic moral values and political values, then that's not right. And so I agree they should do that. But don't forget that Rupert Murdoch has owned a very large chunk of the British press for many, many years, The Sun, The Times.
And I'm not sure his morals are any higher than anyone else.
Exactly.
I would query your suggestion that somehow the UAE was a moral issue. I don't think their morals are to be questioned. They're not immoral people.
No,
they just have different notions of democratic values and how that should be exercised.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
So I think morality is I would remove that from the equation.
Yeah, fair enough. But I think it is it is a bit hypocritical to say that about the Telegraph and the Spectator and not apply the same sort of thinking to something as important as our nuclear power plants.
See, if I was Keir Starmer, I would sort of say, oh, let them have it. Let them have it. Let the, you know, let the Telegraph go to pot.
Yeah, well, of course he would.
So, yeah.
Yeah, yes, the Tories have more to lose. That's true.
It's the extent of government interference. I mean, I've got to be honest, I wasn't particularly happy to see, I mean, it all started with Roman Abramovich, didn't it? He came on in and bought Chelsea. And yeah. Well, before that, all their water companies and utilities are bought by foreign companies. But
but
I think newspapers are more like football clubs than infrastructure assets in the regard that they're more of a cultural prize than a physical asset.
But they are, yeah, and I think that that's quite an interesting point because they have an effect. They can sort of change the national debate. They can skew perceptions to a certain degree, which I think in some ways is more insidious. I mean, with your nuclear power, then yeah, people might be able to switch the lights off and cause problems there. But they can't do much more than disrupt our power, and we can build in safeguards, you know, gas turbines to fill in the gaps when that's not working. There's something a bit more intangible and sneaky about what you can do with an influential national newspaper or news outlet. If we know nowadays with fake news and AI and deep fakes and all the rest of it, this is something which is, I think, worrying a lot of people, influencing, changing perceptions, and that can go an awful long way and soak into every aspect of national life, really.
But you just made your point mentioning AI there, that newspapers do not have the influence that they had 30 years ago.
Mm.
It won't be the Sun what won it this time around by anyone else, because most people get their news
TikTok.
From, you know, FaceSpace or whatever. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you could point that out. You know, how many under 25s read the Telegraph or the Spectator? Not very many.
How many under 60s read the Telegraph?
Sorry?
How many under 60s read the Telegraph?
Yeah, good question. But no, they get their news from Instagram and TikTok and Facebook and stuff like that.
Anyway, I think I'm just looking at the clock, David. I think we're going to bust our 30-minute deadline.
Oh, I think we are, yes. We're nattering on. Is there anything you want to say in finishing? Is there anything else?
I did have one, and finally, which we could have talked about at some length, but I'm just going to have a quick go at this one. Halton Borough Council has agreed that all future construction tender processes undertaken by the council, specifically construction, will include a requirement for the main contractor to include a scored statement around mental health well-being among all staff and subcontractors. So it's only the main contractors, and they'll have to take charge of their subcontractors as well and have a mental health statement. It has become recognised that 10 times as many construction workers take their own lives in England and Wales, mm-hmm. then more than 10 times take their own lives, then die in industrial accidents in the workplace. In other words, physical health and safety, certainly in terms of fatalities,
sure,
is a insignificant problem, relatively speaking, compared to mental health and mental safety. So it is a truth universally to be acknowledged that mental health crisis in construction is a thing.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
However, this move towards adding questions to tender documents, piling on the bureaucracy, and it's fine if you're a big 500 million, billion pound turnover contractor with a big HR department to a... just looking for, you know, happy to see their HR empires expanded, and
you
can take time to fill in your social value, your ESG, your this, that, and the other. But a self-employed freelance contractor of my acquaintance has been working for 20 years for a big company. He was recently told that they now have to add an ESG statement to their tender. And not only that, they've now got to new procurement process outsourced to an agency. If you want to be our supplier any longer, you have to pay this agency, whatever it is, 500 quid a year or something. I mean, it's not going to break the bank, but they say, hang on, you and I have been working together for 20 years on and off, perfectly happily. You know me, you're happy with my work. And now you're telling me if I want to do this job tomorrow, I've got to give that person down the road 500 quid and somehow work out what my ESG policy is, my environment policy. I've got a hybrid car. Is that enough? Do I need to say anything else? Social. I'm a member of the golf club. Does that help? Is that social enough? And, you know, for them, the whole concept of ESG being forced, it's like, and I've said this before about social value. The idea of putting these new clauses, well, certainly social value, was meant to favour the little local business who inherently added more social value than the big international corporation. And it had the opposite effect. We've discussed that in the past at length. And it's the micro company, the SME, the very small businesses, and the smaller the business, the worse they're clobbered by this piling on of questions, which have got nothing to do with the job in hand. It's simply the client trying to make the world a better place. If you want to make the world a better place, go make the world a better place. Don't make life a worse place for the people who you want to do the work for you. It doesn't fit. There used to be a big issue in the 1980s, when I think Nicholas Ridley was the environment secretary at the time, included local government in his department, and Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister, when they introduced legislation called outlawing the practice of contract compliance. In those days, the issue was local authorities, which, because Thatcher had been in power sufficiently long that everyone at local level voted Labour. Well, certainly the big cities, the big metropolitan councils, tended to be not just Labour, but quite strongly left-wing, were adding into their tender documents clauses saying, if you do this job, you're not allowed to buy anything from South Africa, or you're not allowed to eat Jaffa oranges, or, you know, all sorts of things that had nothing to do with the job, but putting in circumstances which, putting in conditions which advanced the political agenda of the council or the council politicians and had nothing to do with the job in hand. And Nicholas really said, enough of this, I'm banning it. And I think we're closely reaching a point where someone needs to come in, and I don't think it'll be the Tories.
I don't think it'll be the
next Labour government. It might take a Suella Braverman type or some right-wing headbanger. Is it slanderous to call her a headbanger?
Yeah.
I don't know. I had chance my arm on that one. But probably take some right-wing headbanger to get it, come in and say, right, all of these contracts, by all means, ask these questions of companies that have got a turnover of more than 100 million, but stop asking of the little guy and do not discriminate against the little guy because he has not got the time to waste filling in all your questions because he's too busy doing the real job.
Mm. I mean, I'm sure that their heart, you know, Holton Borough Council's heart is in the right place. And, you know, you can't ignore the statistics, you know, that suicide and mental health, poor mental health in the construction industry is definitely an issue. So I think you can understand why they thought, well, we must do something to try and, ameliorate this. But maybe they just haven't thought it through
properly.
They're making
it worse. They're adding to the mental health crisis. That's what they don't realise.
Well, by adding the stress to all these poor SMEs. Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I had a similar situation myself, Phil. I mean, nothing to do with my mental health. I'm sure that didn't benefit. But I've been prescribed medication to reduce my blood pressure. And this is a new thing. I'm trying to do it, obviously, by changing lifestyle and diet. But in the meantime, I've got this repeat prescription. I've never had a repeat prescription before. And I realized that my prescription was going to run out at the weekend. So I was told that the best way to renew the prescription was to go on the NHS app, which I did.
Your blood pressure rose. I can see
and
it coming.
It said, yeah, exactly.
Sorry.
Well, I'll cut a long story short, Phil. You've beat me to the, yeah. 15 minutes holding on the phone. And by the end of it, my blood pressure was sky high. I thought that was so ironic. But anyway, there we are. That's probably not for the pod. But but yeah, I can see that something like this would clearly pile on more stress for a small company, because it's just more admin and it seems a bit pointless for them. So I can appreciate
that. The most stressful part of any job is the paperwork, the tax returns and the forms. Yeah. It's not laying bricks or putting up scaffolding.
No, that's for sure.
So that's all I have for this week, David. What about yourself? Anything else?
No, I think we could go on. There are other things to discuss, but we've gone on for an awfully long time now, and I think that we probably said enough.
I'm sure our listener will agree with you. Yeah. So goodbye. Thank you again for listening, and from David and I for another fortnight. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.